是台湾人，
台湾人，
台湾人。
台湾人
Welcome to Taiwan Ren, where you'll hear stories of Taiwanese innovators, makers, and advocates. I'm your host, Cindy, and today we're meeting with Laura Huang, a professor at Harvard Business School, who recently published a book called Edge, Turning Adversity into Advantage. Laura shares the inspiration behind this research, ways we can recognize implicit bias, perceptions, and flip the script on that, and most importantly, how we can all find and build our own edge. I'm so excited about this topic because it's so relevant for many of us in the workplace as persons of color. And I really hope that this is something that's useful to you in your life. So let's get into it. Hi, Laura. Tell us about yourself and your connection to Taiwan.
Hi. Yeah, it's such a pleasure to be here with you. Yeah, I mean, I think my connection to Taiwan goes back to the womb, I guess. So both my parents are from Taiwan. They're Taiwanese. I grew up in a very Taiwanese culture. I think so much of my identity is based on my Taiwanese upbringing. So even though I grew up in a very Caucasian, US-centric neighborhood where there was only two Asian families, right? It was like me and my friend. It was my friend Deepa, who was Indian American, and I. And that was pretty much the extent of the diversity in the town that I grew up. But so much of what I learned when I was young and values and all of the things that are really important in life have come from this Taiwanese upbringing.
Wow. It seems like we have similar upbringings as well, because most of my knowledge came from my family. But how did you, I guess, as an adult, stay in touch with Taiwan?
So pretty much the last 9 years, I've been coming back to Taiwan every summer. So for July and August, those 2 months, we have been in Taiwan. So I've been taking the kids back. And a lot of that was based on me wanting to give the kids the same thing that I sort of had, this connection to Taiwan. I've been really grateful that we've been able to stay so connected to Taiwan, the culture, the language, the food. Even when we are in the US the other 10 months, I try and make sure that it's sort of 50-50 in terms of like the food that I cook. So 50% will be Asian food and 50% will be sort of Western food. I just think it's so important for my kids to have a very similar type of an identity where they feel like they're comfortable and that they can embrace multiple identities, both their US American identity as well as their Asian Taiwanese identity.
More about yourself. You are, of course, a professor at Harvard. Can you tell us about what you teach? I'm like, that's not a major, but what your research is based on.
Yeah, of course. So I teach two courses. I teach one course on leadership, and I teach another course that's called Founder's Journey, which is an entrepreneurship course that is pretty much about the entire entrepreneurship process, right? Everything from how do I come up with an idea to how do I form my team and make my key hires to how do I do fundraising and access the resources that I need to how do I grow and scale my business and exit it. But the focus of the course is on the people side of things. So it's all on that nitty-gritty interactions that we have over the course of founding a company. So things like, how do we split equity with our co-founders and what sort of issues might crop up and what are the danger zones? How do we deal with suppliers? How do we cold call? How do we negotiate a term sheet or even try and pitch investors? How do we think about the market and the customers and how we engage with customers? So all of the sort of people side of things, which is so funny because my background was I was trained as an engineer, so I was an electrical engineer by training. And so when people sometimes are like, well, what do you teach now? What do you study? What do you research? It's this complete 180 from what I used to do. But I do study tech entrepreneurship and tech entrepreneurs. I did maintain some of that core.
I'm wondering, did you always know you would become a professor?
No. I actually still don't. I still don't know that I want to be a professor when I grow up. It's so funny because there are certainly people who, even like from a young age, right, when they were like 5 years old, they're like, oh, I've known that I wanted to be a doctor since I was five, or I've wanted to be, you know, a biologist since I was 10. I actually was one of those people who just never knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. And so I sometimes joke that I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. And I think it's because, like, I spoke a little bit about these like multiple identities that I had. And I think growing up, there was so much of a still trying to figure out who I was and how I could navigate and embrace all of these different parts of who I was. And so there was so much that was interesting to me too. I was just really curious about lots of things. And so I just didn't necessarily want to commit to a particular industry or a particular job. So in retrospect, it does seem like I had a very disparate sort of journey. Like I've worked in, as I mentioned, I was an engineer. I worked in investment banking. I worked in management consulting. I worked in sales and marketing for a large organization. I worked in startups and really small organizations. And now I'm a professor. So I pretty much have done at least half a dozen jobs and careers so far.
I did undergrad and I went to grad school, and I have to say, I've never had an Asian American female professor.
Yeah, I don't think I ever have either. Like now, even thinking back, I don't think I had a single Asian female professor. I had a couple of Asian male professors and even an African American professor and a Hispanic professor, but I've never had an Asian female professor. That's really funny.
That makes me think of, I mean, what we're getting to, maybe it's your book, but it makes me think maybe you found your edge in that.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I'm still, in some ways, I have found my edge, but in some ways, this finding and gaining an edge is something that we're constantly doing. We constantly need to be doing. And, you know, as you sort of mentioned, I'm sure we'll talk about like why this is, but we just live in this day and age where one of the main premises of the book is that as Asian Americans, we're taught from this really young age that so much of success and so much of our journey and so much of what we do is based on hard work, that we should just put our heads down and work hard. And the thing about my research and what into this book is that even though hard work is critical, and I would never say that hard work is not critical, but at the same time, we recognize that part of our frustration is due to all of this time and effort and hard work that we've put in, where hard work doesn't always speak for itself, that hard work alone is not always enough. And that's because there's so much of success and outcomes that's determined by perceptions and signals and subtle cues and stereotypes that are out there. And this book was really around how do we understand the adversity and the obstacles and the constraints and the stereotypes that are out there so that we can actually flip those in our favor, flip those stereotypes in our favor to create our own advantage, to create our own authentic edge.
Yeah, no, that just reminds me of, I haven't gotten to share this with you yet. So it reminds me of my first lesson I learned in corporate, which was the first person I saw get fired was someone who, he worked the hardest. You know, he was a first in, last out every day, and he got fired. I was shocked. I asked my manager, Peter works the hardest. Why is he the one who, you know, got let go? And my manager just said to me, Cindy, it's not about working hard. It's about working smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm glad I learned that early.
Yeah. And it's sort of one of those things where like, it's such a powerful story, right? Because you internalize so much of it. You see somebody who's a colleague of yours and every day they're there, right? They're showing up for work first. They're like the first person there. They're the last person to leave and they're working so hard. And what I think is so heartbreaking is that these individuals are ones that really do care, right? They care and they're giving so much of themselves. But yet part of that frustration is that you can take two people who work equally as hard, or in your case, somebody who works way harder than others. And even if it's just two people who work equally as hard, one will ultimately be more successful and see more of those positive outcomes than the other. And why is that? And again, it's because the success and outcomes are not determined by how hard you're working. So much of what we're taught is like, put your head down and work hard. Even if you're working twice as hard, like even if you need to work twice as hard for half the amount of benefits, just keep working hard. But that ends up leaving us feeling burnt out, feeling more like we're, you know, just hitting our heads against the same wall over and over and over again. What I really wanted to study in my research is how can we inoculate against this sort of things? How can we actually level the playing field? How can we create our own advantages and our own edge when we recognize that hard work alone is not always enough?
I'm sure the audience, whoever's listening now, is itching to know, what is this book? So the book you have published a year ago, it's called, in English, it's Edge, Turning Adversity into Advantage. And you also have it in Mandarin now, which, huge congrats.
Thank you. Thanks.
For our Mandarin listeners, which we actually have many based in Taiwan, the book is called, I'm going to try my best to say, 隐性优势. Am I saying it right?
Yeah, that's great. Very nice.
Oh, practiced. Yes. Can you tell us more about what we can expect from reading this book and what originally inspired you to put it together?
Yeah. So I mentioned a little bit around this aspect of hard work, and the title of the book is Edge, but Edge actually stands for the framework that I've developed over the last decade or so of my research, where the E, D, G, and E actually stand for the components of this framework. So the E stands for enrich, the D stands for delight, the G stands for guide, and the final E stands for effort and hard work. And so the first E is really around enrich. How do we enrich and provide value, right? So each of these is one part of the book, right? Each of these is one large section of the book. And so the E is around, how do we actually think about our strengths, our weaknesses, our underestimated strengths? It's all of the ways in which we enrich and provide value. And the thing about this is that a lot of times we think about, you know, self-awareness, that, oh, how do we enrich that? This is like being self-aware. But what I talk about is that it's more than just self-awareness. It's about understanding that no matter what situation you're in, you can be in various different contexts, and you change one variable, you change the industry that you're operating in, for example, or you change the mix of people that you're interacting with. And those perceptions of your strengths and your weaknesses and your underestimated strengths and the way in which you enrich and provide value are going to differ. And so it's about knowing who you are, but also understanding the perceptions that other people have about you. And that's all a part of this enrich, the first E. The D stands for delight, which is around, how do you delight your counterpart? How do you delight your customers, your colleagues, the people who are around you, anyone that you're sort of interacting with? And the reason why it's so important to understand your unique ways, the unique ways in which you delight and interest other people or have people stand up and sit up and take notice of who you are, is because we don't always have the opportunity to enrich and provide value. That sometimes doors are closed to us. Sometimes we don't belong to the right networks, or we don't belong to the right groups, or we don't look the right way, or we don't speak the right way. And when we're able to delight our counterparts, that's the equivalent of being able to crack that door open a little bit so that others give us that opportunity, or that others take notice of us just for a couple of seconds, so that we have the opportunity to show how we enrich and provide value. The G stands for guide, which is to say that even when we enrich and we delight, we have to constantly be guiding the perceptions that others have about us. And we're guiding them in such a way that it's very authentic, right? This is not about managing impressions. This is not about being strategic, right? We always have those examples of like seeing someone kissing up to the boss and being like, like, I don't want to be that person. I'm not going to do that. But guiding and redirecting the perceptions that others have about you, that's the opposite of that. That's guiding them to who you authentically are. And if I can give like a really quick analogy here around like guiding, you know, I always think about it as like every person, every individual is like a diamond, right? If each of us is a single solitary diamond, in every diamond, there's going to be flaws and different cuts and facets and different ways that it's going to shine based on the lighting or the environmental conditions or the sort of circumstances that we're going to be in or the room that we're in. And there's going to be different coloring and different, like I said, different flaws to every diamond. And when we're guiding the perceptions of others, like all we're trying to do is have them actually see our diamond, but we're starting from this premise of like showing them the side of your diamond that's going to shine the brightest. It's still the same diamond. You still got the same flaws, the same cuts and facets and imperfections. But yet when you show that side of your diamond that's going to shine the brightest, that's when you're going to have the deepest, richest interpersonal connection with them. And so there's an element of delighting and guiding in this. But the guiding chapters, it's actually multiple chapters. The guiding chapters are so critical in this book because it also talks about stereotypes and implicit perceptions and how we can take those perceptions and stereotypes. And as I mentioned before, actually flip them in our favor so that we can create an edge. And then the final E is about effort and hard work, which is sort of where we started from, which is to say that we often think that effort and hard work comes first, but it actually comes last in this framework. Mm-hmm. Because when we know how we enrich and delight and guide, that's when our effort and hard work actually work harder for us. That's when we get those tailwinds. That's when we know how we enrich and delight and guide, that's when we can work twice as hard. Not for half the amount of benefits, but why not work twice as hard for twice the amount of benefits or even three times the amount of benefits? And so that's sort of the edge framework in a nutshell or in a slightly, I know that was sort of long, but in a slightly condensed version than the 270 pages of the book.
No, that was so good. Thank you. And it makes so much sense to me. It makes me think of even just like startup framework, right? You should come up with what is your value prop? What's your strategy? And then implement and then put in that work.
Absolutely. And I think so much of like my research, right? Because my research, I study uncertainty, I study disadvantage, I study entrepreneurs that are underestimated. The book is very research backed, right? So I integrate a lot of my research on entrepreneurs, on entrepreneurship into this. So you're absolutely right.
And maybe we'll just dig into a little bit of each section. For me, the hardest one is the first one. A lot of my friends don't know what they're good at. Or it's, you know, you kind of live and it's hard to know what is it about you that makes you you. So I wonder, do you have, and I know it's different for everyone, but do you have tips to help us find our something?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, like to kind of give a couple of tips around this. So the first part of it is like, how do we think about our superpowers? And how do we think about those underlying perceptions that others have about our skills and the value we bring? And then, you know, how do we flip that? How do we sort of turn and redirect that in our favor, right? So it's definitely the first section, but it has, even throughout the book, I'm weaving in like tips and strategies around how do we make this really actionable? One way to sort of explain or give some examples is to tell a little bit about like the reasons why I got into this research in the first place. So we talked about how both my parents are Taiwanese and I grew up as the child of Taiwanese immigrants in the US. And so I remember as a child seeing both of my parents, my mother and my father, getting turned down for promotion after promotion after promotion. And I remember during one of these denied promotions that my father was denied this promotion, that the person who became his boss, the person who he ended up reporting to, that everyone in the organization sort of knew that he wasn't qualified to be his boss. And my father was actually doing that person's job, right? He was doing the job of his boss because that person wasn't qualified. And so I remember asking my father, like, why is it that you think you didn't get that promotion? And I was sort of too young to kind of understand things like, you know, discrimination and implicit bias and perceptions. But I do remember that my father said, I don't know, it's probably because of my accent or the way I communicate or something like that. And so years and years later, when I became a researcher, I wanted to sort of study whether or not something like someone's accent could lead to these disparities and these disadvantages. And I found that based on someone's accent, having a non-standard American accent, for example, was enough for people to be less likely to get a raise, to get a promotion, to get hired into certain positions, including top management team positions. They were less likely to get funding for their ventures, all sorts of things. And so I wanted to test whether or not it was about like something like communication. So I would take, for example, four people who had accents, four people who didn't have accents, and I'd have them present to a panel of investors, for example, right? They would be entrepreneurs with accents, entrepreneurs without accents. But I didn't ask the investors, who would you invest in? Because I already knew that they were less likely to invest in those with accents. Instead, I just told them to write down three things that they learned or three things that they remember from each of these entrepreneurs. And I found that the investors were just as likely to have learned things, to recall things, to remember things, to be impressed by things from those who had accents than those who didn't. So it wasn't about communication skills. But what I found was that there were the lay perceptions that they would have about these individuals with accents. They would be things like, for example, one person, they'd say, oh, he or she is less likely to be interpersonally influential, or for someone else, they're not as good of a team player, or they're not as creative or out of the box thinking. That there were these lay perceptions that was driving their likelihood to invest in these individuals. What I then did was I would tell these individuals before going into an interview situation or something like that, I would run a series of studies where I would tell them, you know, right before interviewing for a top management team job, I would say to them, the perception they have about you is that you're not as interpersonally influential, or the perception they have about you is that you're not as good of a team player, or the perception they have about you is that you're not as creative or out of the box thinking. And then these individuals would go into these interviews and they would say really astounding things. I'd hear them saying things like, because they would get asked questions like, tell me about a time when you're, you know, or if I was your manager, what would you do in this situation? And I would hear them saying things like, let me tell you about a time when I fought for resources for my team. Or let me tell you about a time when I had to close this sales deal and I didn't stop until I did it. And I did it in this really creative way. They were giving examples of times when they were interpersonally influential or when they were out of the box thinking or that they were like team players. And what I found was that not only were they more likely to get the job or the raise or the promotion, and not only were they more likely to be getting rated higher in terms of things like interpersonal skills or being a team player or thinking outside the box, they are rated significantly higher in terms of their communication skills. In terms of their accent, they were getting rated lower in terms of like how thick of an accent did they have or, you know, so something that they didn't even talk about. They didn't go in and talk about their accent or their communication skills. But just by addressing these underlying perceptions, they were able to guide and redirect these negative sort of signals and cues that others were making about them. This is just one example of the research that I've been doing that shows how perceptions that we have these sort of positive and negative perceptions, and they cluster together, where just like there's a thin line between love and hate, right? And we sort of might love someone in one instance and hate them in another instance. So too do these perceptions toggle between the positive and negative manifestations, where someone might have a negative perception of us, but that we can toggle it or flip it to that positive manifestation of it. Just like we were able to impact the ways in which they see us communicating based on addressing these underlying perceptions. So these are the sort of stories and tips and tactics and strategies that I sort of explain and talk about in my book.
I love it as a follow-up to one of our earlier episodes we did last year with Asian Boss Girl. We introduced the concept of bamboo ceiling. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a bamboo ceiling breaker, right? So because it's already on their mind that this is something working against you, you face it head on.
Absolutely. Sort of, yeah. And I mean, I think we can face it head on, especially when we start to recognize these underlying perceptions. So sometimes, right, and that whole first section of my book is around how do we hone our ability to see the underlying perceptions that others have about us, right? How do we develop that intuition around how others see us and how others perceive us and the attributions that they're making about us?
Mm. And another story I really liked from the book, I think it's with Ashley Edwards, Mind Right story, where, you know, she talked about embracing two worlds. And I think that's something that a lot of Asian Americans or people of color have to deal with, this idea of multiple identities and which one you sort of have to lean into depending on your context. I just love that she realized she can use being of multiple backgrounds to her advantage.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's what we as Asian Americans or Asians, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, that we can also do, that we can really embrace these multiple identities that we have. And, you know, it actually gives us so much. It helps us in terms of being able to do perspective taking. Like, we're much better at taking others' perspectives. Mm-hmm. We're much more empathetic. It allows us to really get a deeper understanding of context, of individual motivations. There's so much that this allows us to do. So it's an asset, even though it makes it hard in certain situations, it also does really provide us with an edge in other situations.
I think the part I identified with as well was this, the bitterness that you talked about. Well, I would say my high school years, I wasn't exactly proud to be Asian.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so it's so funny that you mentioned that. Like, there were definitely things where I was trying so hard to fit in and fit into whatever the norms that I was seeing, right? So everything from, like, I was a cheerleader in high school, right? I don't know if I ever really loved cheerleading, but it was like the status symbol in high school, right? And so I was like, okay, well, that's kind of how you belong. That's how you show that you're well-liked and that you have status. And so I was like, I'm going to do that too, right? And I sort of did it. And it makes me kind of chuckle now, because I think back and I was the only sort of individual who was shuffling myself back and forth between like cheerleading practice and like preparation for like the AP calculus exam, right? Like, I was sort of like, you know, managing these multiple identities at the same time that I was trying to like fit in and belong, right? There was enough of like who I was and what I wanted to do, but also like this aspect of who I thought I needed to be, who I thought I needed to be in order to belong and fit in. And so there absolutely is that piece of it too. The bitterness part is so funny, because the last chapter of my book, I remember my editor and my publisher sort of saying like, wow, the last chapter of your book is super powerful, but also really negative. And for a book that's around like hope and success and empowerment, like, it's sort of a interesting negative take on, you know, it's like, it's an interesting sort of way to end a book where you talk about like being really bitter and jaded. And I remember saying to them, yeah, like, I just feel like it's more realistic. It's more real. Like, I also want to be, I want to mean every word of this book, right? I want everything to really be something meaningful. And I think such an important part of really gaining someone's edge, gaining your edge, is understanding that there is going to be failure. There are going to be drawdown. There are going to be these periods of time when you are bitter and jaded. But I also want people to understand that this question that I ask of myself, right, that I talk about in this book, of in any situation, asking yourself, is this making me bitter or is this making me better? And it's hard to really understand that without actually talking about that bitterness, because the bitterness and the failure, it's like we do have these wounds and these wounds are going to be there, but it's, do we now have scar tissue that protects us, right? It's still going to be there. It's still going to be very salient to who we are. But if there's scar tissue that now protects us, it's something where it does make us better, right? And it's no longer. And so it really is like, is it making us bitter or is it making us better? And how do we get to this point where the experiences that we've had, the failures that we've had, the times when we've been stabbed in the back, the times where we've really experienced this negativity, that it does allow us to be better and not bitter. And I think that that's such an important piece of it, because bitterness does hold us back, but we cannot get through it without actually experiencing it.
I know it's a different context, but growing up, it does make me think so much of what my mom says, which is to, in Mandarin, it's 吃苦, right? Mm-hmm. Which to eat your bitterness.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think it's something we've heard, right? Like, it's something that's so ingrained in us. And I do think that our ability to 吃苦 does make us stronger. It's just, how do we think about this in the context of who we are as individuals, what we've accomplished, the types of failures that we have, so that it does help make us better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, so I guess while I was reading this book, it's definitely a book focused on you and yourself, but then I couldn't help but think of, how do I help others find their edge as well? How am I sort of being a, maybe not a part of the problem, but being a part of the system? So how could I adjust my own behavior so I don't inadvertently become an obstacle to other people? Do you have any advice for that?
Yeah. I mean, I talk a lot about how, you know, when I initially set out to study disadvantage and disparities and people who are underestimated, when I started presenting this work, a lot of people would come up to me afterwards and ask that very same question, like, what can we do about this, right? Are there ways that we can level the playing field? Are there ways that we can make sure that we are trying to help and be a part of the solution? And what was interesting is that so much of what I found, so much of the research that has been done is all around like system level solution or structural or organizational level solutions. And what I mean by that is that it's all these solutions that are sort of from the outside in, right? Solutions that are like, well, let's try and be more equitable in our hiring practices. Let's try and use like checklists that are more fair, or let's try and develop algorithms to help us do more blind hiring, or let's try and work on the leaky pipeline issue. Let's try and have more women and minorities in positions of power or as mentors. It was all these like sort of structural solutions. And these are all steps in the right direction, right? Like, these are all great things. But what I also found in my research was that these sort of solutions were also leaving individuals really frustrated, even leaders who were trying to create change. It was leaving individuals within organizations really frustrated, because it was almost like saying to people, just wait, right? We know that this is an imperfect system. We know that there's a myth of meritocracy. Just wait. Wait until we fix things from the outside in. Wait until we try and make this more meritocratic. But there wasn't a lot that as individuals, as leaders, as team members, that we could do from the inside out, right? That we could be doing to sort of empower people and to be trying to do things that even within an imperfect system, that we could be trying to approach this differently. And so a lot of the solutions that I sort of offer, it's really this perspective around, how do we sort of take things and really redirect them in a way? And, you know, I'll give another quick example of something really like a tip or like a strategic, like a strategy that people can take both for themselves as well as others, right? So I found, for example, that as individuals, based on who we are and what we look like, that we're more likely overwhelmingly in life to get asked a certain type of question over another type of question. So there are two different types of questions largely in the world, right? There are questions that are like, you know, what does success look like to you? Or what's your vision? Or what's your overall outlook in life? And I'm making this really obvious, but like, that's sort of one type of question. And the second type of question are things like, what type of people are you least likely to get along with? Or what type of, you know, right? So these sort of, these two different types of questions are what I find and what other researchers find are called either prevention-focused questions or promotion-focused questions, right? So promotion-focused questions are those that are around like the success and how big you could take something and the vision and the opportunities. And prevention-focused questions are ones that are like around the risks or the obstacles or the constraints behind something. And what I find is that based on, again, who we are, what we look like, how we speak, how we communicate, we're more likely to either get asked prevention-focused questions or promotion-focused questions in our lives, in the workplace, in our personal lives, and in every sort of arena or sphere that we operate in. And Asians and Asian Americans, for example, are more likely to get asked prevention-focused questions. And so I see this in lots of contexts, right? So in entrepreneurship, I study entrepreneurs, I find that women and minorities and Asians are more likely to get asked questions like, how many daily and monthly users do you have? Or what's your break-even point? Or did you Turing test this? You know, questions that it's, again, not as obvious, but still very much prevention-focused question. Mm-hmm. And others are more likely to get asked questions that are things like, what other target customers do you think you can go after in the next couple of years? Or what other products do you think you could extend this to in the future? Where do you think you could scale this to in the next couple of years? Right? There are these questions around opportunities and how big you could take something. And what happens is that when we are asked a prevention-focused question, we respond in turn. We stay at that level of the nitty-gritty. We talk about the competitors. We talk about break-even points. We talk about daily and monthly users. And when we get asked promotion-focused questions, we talk about the vision, the opportunity, future customer targets, market segments. And so at the end of the day, who is the investor going to invest in? Of course, he or she is going to invest in the person who talks about how big it's going to be or the opportunity behind something and so on and so forth. So what do we do about this, right? What do we do about this? What I find in my research is that when we recognize that we're getting asked, for example, a prevention-focused question, we do answer it, but we do it quickly, and then we flip it to a promotion-oriented response. So if somebody says to us, wow, there are a lot of competitors in this industry, how could you ever compete? You answer the question. You say, yes, there are a lot of competitors. There's competitor X and Y and Z. But what our product or service is able to do is all of these things that allow us to go after future customers and expand to different product lines and, you know, so on and so forth. So we answer the prevention-focused question, but we flip it to a promotion-oriented response. And when we do this, I find that not only are we able to raise more funding or whatever the outcome is, we're actually able to raise more funding than those who were only asked promotion-focused questions. We actually gain an edge over those who are only asked promotion-focused questions. So your question was around also, how can we use these sort of things in our everyday lives? Well, what I find is that when we recognize that others are, for example, staying very much at the prevention level. They're talking about the nitty-gritty. They're talking about things that are much more around the constraints or the obstacles, that when we ask them things like, well, where else could you take this? Or how could you extend this, right? Mm-hmm. How could you extend this in the future? That not only are the individuals that we work with and our teams and the people that we're leading, are they more creative and do they empower themselves and come up with new solutions for themselves? We also like them more. They like us more. We develop deeper connections with them. We engage with them more, that it actually advances everyone, that people will come up with different approaches, that people will come up with different solutions. And the same thing, if they're staying at the very promotion level, that if you ask them like details around, like, well, what are the first three steps that you would take to actually take this forward, right? That when we engage with people in these different ways, that it actually reduces bias and perceptions and all of these sort of negative aspects of how we perhaps typically engage with people, that there are ways that we can take these by being aware of how we interact with people. So this is just one small example. I talk about lots of ways that we interact with people, but wanted to give you something sort of concrete around how can we actually inoculate against these signals and cues and perceptions that seem to pervade and lead our lives.
I couldn't help but think, whoever tuned into the prevention versus promotion, they're going to get that job offer now, which is great.
I hope so. I hope that there's something really practical and that people will be able to use this in really effective ways.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's like a wonderful thing, but the amazing thing about implicit bias is you have to recognize, you know, usually the person asking the question, they don't know either. is what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, doesn't matter. For example, I find that women are more likely to get asked prevention focused questions, but both men and women, like male and female investors, are equally likely to be asking other women entrepreneurs these prevention focused questions. So the beauty of this is that we don't necessarily always have to be aware of these dynamics. You sort of mentioned like this implicit bias and these perceptions. Like, it is the poison, right? The poison of not being judged based on like our hard skills or the quantitative data. But just like it's the poison, it's also the antidote, right? Because we're not judged just based on quantitative skills and hard skills and these very, you know, analytical things, we have the opportunity to be able to shape perceptions and the opportunity to show who we are in deeper, richer ways that can really allow us to engage with people in different ways.
Mm-hmm. So you coined the term work hard, but there's a hard work plus.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're not saying don't work hard anymore, but there's a plus to it. Can you talk about the plus?
Yeah. The plus is really that working hard alone is not enough, right? It speaks to this understanding that the more we understand those perceptions, those underlying perceptions that others have about us, the ways in which we enrich and delight and guide, the more our hard work is actually going to work for us. That's that plus. And there is this element of like working smart, right? Thus work hard versus working smart. But it goes beyond just working smart, right? Working smart seems to suggest that there's some agenda behind that, or there's something there that it's some sort of opportunistic type of thing attached to it. But work hard plus is really around your hard work is going to do more for you just naturally when we help guide, when we know the ways in which we enrich and the ways in which we delight and the ways in which these perceptions may or may not be accurate, but that we can lead them to who we authentically are. So this hard work plus is really this mantra that I ascribe to. I always think about like working hard, but it's working hard plus.
So you're a mom. I'm sure you probably think about this all the time because I'm in education as well. I'm constantly thinking about how do we apply this to the next generation? So how can we raise the next generation so they approach work and worth differently than maybe the way we did growing up?
Yeah. I mean, I think about this a lot. You're right, right? Like as a mother of two kids, not only as the mother of two kids, I often have parents always asking me like, how do I get my kids into Harvard? Like, what's the way to raise kids? As if I know how to like, as if, you know, being a professor somehow gives you authority on how to raise kids. But in terms of parenting, the thing about being parents is that we love our children and we want to give our kids opportunities, right? We want to give our kids opportunities to thrive and to succeed. And there is nothing wrong with that, except that what it has become, that nowadays it's become that we are trying to give our kids an advantage. And in of itself, that also is not bad. But what happens is that we try and give our kids an advantage by thinking around certain dimensions, right? Like giving our kids extra tutoring so that they have an advantage in terms of schoolwork, or giving our kids an advantage by private coaching, or, you know, exposure to certain extracurricular activities. It starts to get worse and worse where you see stories of parents trying to buy their kids' way into certain universities or paying, right? So we see like in the news, right, these stories of parents trying so hard to give their kids an advantage that it turns into something that goes beyond what they would have expected. And again, it's not necessarily a bad thing to be providing our kids with extracurricular activities and exposure to these sort of things. But what we start to forget is that when we strive so hard to give them an advantage, that sometimes we're giving them an advantage in one dimension, right? We're trying to give them an advantage in terms of their studies, their education, getting into a college or a specific college. But what I tell parents is, why not teach your kids? Why not teach your children how to cultivate their own advantage? If you teach your kids how to cultivate their own advantage, it doesn't matter what situation they're going to be in. It could be in college, it could be with their friends, it could be with, you know, their boss, it could be in a work environment, in an internship, that they are understanding the ways in which they enrich and understanding the perceptions that others have about them so that they can cultivate their own edge in any sort of circumstance that they're going to be in. So it's not necessarily just about getting them extra tutors. It's about teaching them what are their skills, what are their superpowers, what are the areas in which they can explore and perhaps rely on these tutors in a deeper way or in a more thorough or thoughtful way so that they can approach their own work and lives differently and create their own advantages so that they don't get to a point where they are saying, well, I don't even know how to do that myself because I've always had other people that I can rely on that have done that for me. And part of that is in the struggle, is in the failure, is in that bitterness that they hone for themselves in understanding the perceptions that people have about them and how they can delight and how they can guide to make their own hard work work in a way that works for them.
Oh, that's so wonderful. And I just think it's such an important skill in today's world, right? Like, we don't know what's going to happen in the next 5 years, 10 years. So
absolutely. So when we empower them with those sort of skills, we can trust that they'll be able to find their own edge, no matter how things sort of ebb and flow and how things shift and the way the world looks in the future.
Okay. So we'll end this with, how has your work evolved your relationship with Taiwan or your Taiwanese identity?
There's so many different pieces to that. I think what I have recognized increasingly is that, you know, not everyone has the same opportunities, right? There's a friend of mine once said that intelligence is distributed equally across all zip codes, but opportunities are not, right? So meaning like intelligence and creativity and all of these things, like there's intelligence and creativity in all different zip codes across all different areas, but the opportunities are not distributed equally across all of those zip codes. And so I think often about, you know, the students that I teach and all of the students who are out there that maybe don't have the opportunity to get a Harvard education or the Harvard curriculum or, you know, I think about how my life would have been differently if I had grown up in Taiwan versus the US, or if I had grown up in a certain area of Taiwan versus in a large city. And so a lot of my work now is trying to bring my research and bring sort of these tips and the things that we talked about here to lots of different communities, to lots of different zip codes. So one of the saddest things for me in terms of seeing education is kids who have given up, right? Kids who have been told at a really young age that your grades aren't good enough, you're not good at math, hearing teachers saying things like, oh, ni mei zhou, right? Things like that. And yet, I think there's so much opportunity and potential that still exists in underserved communities and underprivileged communities. And so there's a nonprofit that I'm helping to work to get off the ground called Project Amplify, where we're trying to bring these lessons, bringing these tips and these soft skills, bridging the gap between what we learn in school and what's sort of required in the workplace to really help people understand how they can empower themselves and really gain and cultivate their own edge. So that's what I think about a lot when I think about my own background and the opportunities that I've been given and the different identities that I have, is really trying to help and empower people, no matter what their identity and what their circumstances, that they really can do it and that they can gain an edge and achieve success and outcomes, positive outcomes, regardless of where they started, where they may be based and sort of what their circumstances are.
How can we support Project Amplify?
ProjectAmplify.org. So Amplify is EMPLIFY. projectamplify.org. Check it out. It's a program where we do three different components. We do free workshops and education where I talk about how to gain an edge. We also have lots of other facilitators that talk about various different topics. We're always looking for mentors because we have a mentoring program. So it's free workshops and education, mentoring, and a book matching program. So providing students with sort of books, education, and resources that allow them to really see their potential and empower themselves. So anyone who's willing to help, as anything from contributing your time in terms of mentoring, your skills in terms of workshops, any money that you're willing to sort of donate towards supporting these students, it's all tax deductible and goes 100% into these kids and these children. So yeah, thank you for your support and thank you for, you know, raising awareness to this sort of work.
You can purchase Edge on Amazon or by searching indiebound.org for your local publisher. To support Project Amplify, please go to projectamplify.org, and that is E-M-P-L-I-F-Y. Remember to rate, subscribe, and tell your friends. Thank you for listening. Taiwan 加油!